clock.
From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So maybe it's not the best idea to have a show about Utah's bad air when we've got one of those days where the air isn't so bad. If you're in Salt Lake City like I am, you can actually see out over the valley today to the Ochre Mountains. But the physician and activist Brian Minch says that's not the way to look at it. The impacts of the really bad air over the last few weeks, he says, will take time to work their way out of your system. The inflammatory process, he says, will take weeks to quiet down. The mortality rate will be up for a month. Dr. Minch says this is an emergency. And for years now, he's been asking state leaders to do something. But what? Today in the program, we're talking about what you do about the bad air. This is one of those shows where we're hoping to hear from you. So please join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what many of you have been talking about for weeks now, the bad air in the state, the nasty brown shroud that descends over some of northern Utah's valleys during the peak of winter and summer. We'll be talking about various parts of the problem, but really we're interested in this question, just what exactly do you do about it? It's true we're bound by certain realities, by geography and topography. That's a natural problem. So is the weather, of course. But there are other realities that we may have more control over, like our perspective on the issue, our culture, our politics, the way we plan and build our communities. Joining us first on the program is Tom Wharton. He's a longtime columnist and writer at the Salt Lake Tribune, and he wrote an essay recently in the paper that we're going to talk to him about. Tom, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here, Doug.
So you write in this piece what it was like to go away for a time. You were in Mesquite, Nevada for a couple of weeks, and then you came back. And you talked about in the story how it gave you a different perspective. First, talk about what got you thinking about that.
Well, I was diagnosed in December with asthma, and I didn't think at 62 years of age that you could get asthma. But apparently, the lung specialist says that older folks are getting asthma more and more in Utah. So we went down to our place in Mesquite. I covered a conference in Las Vegas, and I had no trouble walking or breathing down there. Played 63 holes of golf, did some walking, and felt really good. We returned to the Salt Lake Valley Saturday night before the last big snowstorm, and we could smell the air as we come across the point of the mountain.
Literally smell it.
And my wife commented, wow, I can just smell it. It's so bad. And so I had been feeling pretty good about the breathing issues that I've had. Mm-hmm. We get to our driveway, and I unload the truck, and suddenly I can't breathe. I'm coughing, and I can't get enough air. And my wife looks at me and says, what's going on? And I said, I don't know whether it's the bad air or what's going on, but I said, I can't breathe. And I didn't have this problem yesterday.
Yeah. I guess the thing, it's interesting when you went to this lung specialist who told you you had asthma, which was surprising. But the point being, I think, that was interesting to me was that your lungs had literally deteriorated.
Yes, they're operating at about 46% capacity. And as somebody that's been pretty active my whole life, I am a little overweight, but I've been on top of most of the mountains on the Wasatch and has been very active. All of a sudden, not being able to walk around the block or walk up the stairs without having an asthma attack and feeling like you can't breathe, it's pretty scary.
Yeah. Those of us who've lived here for any amount of time have always, I think, on some level, just kind of accepted that the air is the way it is. You know what I mean? Like, well, that's what it's like here. I mean, you know, January, it gets really gunky. July, August, it gets really gunky, and that's just the way it is. But you write this in your piece. You write, these inversions now seem much more than an ugly inconvenience. Are you sensing something – there's something different about all of this?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the way the human mind works, and I would say that I'm no different than anybody else, is when it starts affecting you directly, you start thinking about it a little more seriously.
Yeah.
And I noticed that I have a 4-year-old granddaughter in Flagstaff, Arizona, who has severe asthma. And when my daughter brings her up to visit and there's an inversion, it really impacts the way they breathe. They have to do all kinds of treatments, and you're worried that she might end up in the hospital, which she does occasionally, with lung issues. So that kind of brought it home a little bit. And then all of a sudden you realize that you can't breathe when you're trying to walk around the block, and it just changes your perspective a little bit.
Yeah.
And you always try to do, you know, you feel like you're trained to be a good citizen, but we're all selfish in our own way. I drive a 2003 Prius that I try to drive most of the time in the city. And it's a very low emission vehicle, but, you know, you start looking at it and you say, well, maybe I should telecommute more. Maybe I should take mass transit more than I do. What other kind of things can you do in your lifestyle to change, to eliminate more pollution? And it just gives you a different perspective on what you should do personally, because it's really easy to blame everybody else. Yep. But, you know, what am I doing wrong?
Yep. I think that's the thing that's interesting about your piece is you talk about it from – it hit you personally. It's affecting a family member of yours. It's affecting you. It's literally affecting the – and I guess I'm wondering if you think that's where – the change will come is when it becomes personal for people.
I think it probably will be. And I'm wondering, I haven't done any of the research on this. I'm sure Judy and Brian, that'll be coming in a minute, will have better research than I do. But I'm wondering if these lung issues aren't getting better or aren't getting worse in Utah, in the Salt Lake Valley, that more and more asthma is showing up, more and more people are having breathing issues, and all of the health problems that go along with that. I don't know the answer to that, but I wonder.
You raise one of, I think, is the critical question in the story. You say, how in a free society can you force companies or individuals to do the right thing? How do you? Have you figured it out?
Well, there is the definition of freedom, and does somebody's freedom to drive wherever they want, whenever they want, with a polluting vehicle start impacting my freedom to be able to breathe? But it's a tricky question. For example, I did a column earlier this year on the refineries in North Salt Lake, in Davis County, and they provide almost 97.5% of the gasoline that we use in Utah to drive. So it's really easy to say, well, let's shut those down or move them, but are we willing to pay the costs of increased gas? California has a different gas blend that has helped eliminate their pollution to a great deal. Are we willing to pay more for gasoline for better air quality? Are we willing to have Kennecott work even more on their particular pollution and spend more money and perhaps lose the 2,000 or 3,000 jobs that Kennecott Rio Tinto has at the copper mine? What sacrifices are we willing to make as a society? Are we willing to reduce the price of mass transit so more people can afford it, more people can use it? I have a friend that lives in Saratoga Springs. He was very excited about Front Runner and was going to start taking Front Runner instead of driving his car. Then he looked at the costs, and Front Runner would cost him $100, $150 more a month, I believe he said, to take than just driving his Honda Civic that gets better, pretty decent gas mileage, and it was a longer commute. So he said, well, you know, the cost benefit just isn't there.
Yeah.
But you're talking just finances. What is the cost benefit to the air quality?
Yeah. Well, these are the equations that people are working out.
Yeah.
as they go through all of this. Let's take some calls. Gary is with us, calling from Sandy. Gary, welcome.
Yeah, so I've been asthmatic for 30 years, and I've lived in Utah probably all but about 12 of those years. Mm. And this has been an ongoing issue for me, and I'm really frustrated that the politicians, such as people at the legislature and the governor, they just kind of seem to bat their eyes and say, there's not a lot we can do, and maybe everything we can do is only voluntary. And I just don't think it's getting the job done, and I feel like... you know, with this last inversion, I actually had to take my family and go out of town to escape the air quality. I couldn't really go outside, and I had to limit my activity. I had to use some of my medicines that I don't normally have to use because it had gotten that bad. So I would just really like them to actually, you know, I'm frustrated kind of with the one-sided politics in Utah where people like to deny climate change and all those kinds of things. I also feel like sometimes we're denying how bad the air quality is in the winter, and I don't understand if there, why there's no innovation or attempts to try and minimize it and make it so that it's not as bad for people.
Yeah. Well, Gary, we're going to get to this question of what the government may or may not be doing as we go along. We're glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Back to the phones. Jacob is joining us in Provo. Jacob, hi.
Hi. I've been an activist, an environmental activist for a few years now, as well as a social activist. And I think when we start looking at, you know, what we can do as individuals, we really get away from the issue. Until we can change the way our society functions, the way our economy works, these problems will just be moved from one area to the other. We need to have rationally planned economies rather than the anarchy of the capitalist market. I think the fundamental problem here is the short-sighted profit-seeking economy that really have no respect for future generations or the health of people who work in the factories and who consume the products. That was my comment. I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, let me ask you before you go. Do you figure, Jacob, that this state has the will to make those changes? And I'm wondering if you're thinking if it's going to get bad enough for people to start considering some of those changes.
I absolutely do think it's going to get bad enough. It already is bad enough. And whether it's uprisings in Spain, Greece, native protests like the ones happening in Canada right now, people are becoming aware, and it's all connected. The social issues, gay rights, it's all connected, and it's one fight. I think this generation is bold enough and smart enough to fix things.
Jacob, thanks. Glad you called. Back to the phones. Heather with us in Salt Lake. Heather, hi.
Hi, Doug. My husband, Soren Simonson, serves on the Salt Lake City Council.
Yes.
And he just finished his master's thesis at Westminster about this very topic of how do we solve this problem of the horrible air quality and pollution we have in Salt Lake. And I think he's really on to something, and that is we need to stop looking at it as a political issue and more as a health issue, a community issue, almost like cancer. I mean, no one would argue that cancer is deadly and that it affects all of us in one way or another. And if we can start looking at air quality issues and pollution like that and reach across the aisles, we could find solutions. I mean, you look up at the Huntsman Cancer Institute, where they have researchers working together with doctors. They're right on the front lines with the patients. They're communicating in a new way and having incredible results. If we could have legislators working with city councilmen and women, working with activists in the communities, concerned moms and dads, we would be able to get so much done because it's a community issue. It's a health issue.
Yeah, stay with us. Tom Wharton.
Well, one of the things that I noticed where you talk about cities and the legislature working last year with your husband on the city council is last year the Salt Lake City Council passed a anti-idling ordinance where you couldn't keep your car on just at idle for more than 2 minutes. And the legislature, sponsored by my representative, came out and actually overruled the city and said the city can't do that. And that's where you get the frustration, I think, among some people as to whether we have the political will to do this, and we might have to do this personally rather than politically.
Heather, what do you mean, and what does your husband mean when they say we can't think of it as a political problem? How are we thinking of it politically? What do they mean by that?
Well, it's so divisive between the right and the left,
yeah.
You know, where it becomes an issue of power and leverage of where our funds going, who is in political power.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge mistake because the air quality affects all of us. I mean, if you look at it even from an economic perspective, it's going to affect visitors coming to Utah in January, tourism in January and February, and people wanting to, you know, we made the national news last weekend as the worst air quality in the country, four times what's considered unsafe. So it affects us economically. It affects us, our health issues. If we can start looking at it that way instead of this power play between Democrats and Republicans, if we can look at this, hey, this is an issue we have to address, I think we can get so much more accomplished through collaboration. And that's a great example that you talked about where the legislature came in and said no, you know, to the anti-idling ordinance. But that would have been a huge gain for Salt Lake City in decreasing pollution. And, you know, as a mom of young children and teenagers, you know, I'm very concerned when you go out on a day like we had a few days ago and last weekend where it kind of looks like Armageddon. We live in this beautiful place and you can't see, you know, 10 feet in front of you, and everybody's coughing in the family. And I just think we need to kind of stop the insanity and stop looking at it as a power play between the right and the left and come together. Think we're smart people. Let's solve this together. Let's find solutions that benefit us all.
Glad you called, Heather. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Doug.
Here's a comment from Ryan who writes, I haven't thought too much about the air until more recent years because I was diagnosed with asthma. I try to drive as little as possible. I wish I could use UTA to get to work each day to cut back even more, but unfortunately it's proven not to be viable where I live and where my job is located. And Ryan, we'll get to that issue, the question of mass transit, as we go along. Thanks very much for that. M.E. writes, in Bogota and Medellin, Colombia, there's a system called Pico y Placa, which restricts the use of both private and public vehicles during certain days or hours based on the last digit of the license plate number. It seems like a drastic measure, but the situation is dire, and just like people are given a ticket for speeding, we should start holding people responsible, M.E. writes, for a behavior that's proven to have detrimental effects on the health of people in the valley. 801-585-WEST, the number two. Join the conversation. Tanya is with us in Salt Lake. Tanya, welcome.
Hi. My comment has to do, and I know it's politically incorrect, but the LDS Church arguably controls a lot of different issues around here, and if they would decide that this is a health issue and a community issue, then I think, you know, they could say, hey, don't drive to church this week, walk, you know, and worry about what is and isn't good for their children, then maybe, you know, if they would wake up and say something, I mean, a whole lot would change really quickly, in my opinion.
That did sound terribly politically incorrect, I don't think. Tom Wharton, what do you think? I mean, this question of, look, it is the cultural reality of this place. If leaders of the LDS Church were to say something about it, could have a profound effect, I suppose.
I think it probably would. Saying, you know, the health of our members is very important, and the image that the headquarters of the LDS Church, when it looks as bad as it is, I think anything you can do voluntarily before you have the heavy arm of the government come in is preferable, but we might be to the point where we will have to look at some regulations.
I think I was having a conversation with Dan Bomas this morning in our newsroom, and he was talking about the fact that maybe we've dealt with the low-hanging fruit part. We've dealt with the stuff that is sort of easier, and now we're going to have to start making some really difficult decisions that might be controversial and might be expensive.
I think that's what California had to do about 10, 15 years ago with low-emission autos when I was doing my column, I researched what California did, and it's amazing. There are certain kinds of cars that if you move there, you're probably going to have to sell your car. It's a very much more strict than we have. Some people have said when the air inversion is this bad, maybe you lower the speed limit to 55 in the valley for a few days. And then there's the whole issue of industrial pollution and whether you have the heavy arm of the federal government come in, and which the state obviously resents. It seems to me like the state should be handling it first.
Here's an email from Becky, who writes, idling, idling, idling. If I see another parent idling in front of my house for 15 minutes while they wait for their kid, I'm going to lose it. I knocked on the window of a guy outside a store. He was idling when I walked into the store and still idling when I left 20 minutes later. I asked him nicely if he would consider not idling when our air was so bad. His response, but I'll freeze. It was 40 degrees at the time, Becky writes. Tom Wharton is with us, longtime columnist and writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, and we will take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the nasty, crappy air that settles into certain Utah valleys at the peak of the winter and the summer. A lot of us have spent a good amount of time over the last few weeks complaining about it, but here's the question for today. What exactly can we do about it, really? Tom Wharton is with us here in the studio, longtime columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining us is Judy Fays, a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, where she covers pollution, climate change, nuclear waste. Judy, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
We also have with us Dr. Brian Mensch, the president of the group Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. He's been a longtime activist on this issue. And Dr. Mensch, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How bad is it?
It's bad enough that in the opinion of a substantial slice of the medical community that we're experiencing a public health emergency. And the reason why we think this year is a little different, obviously we've had recurrent episodes of these inversions this winter, for a good portion of the winter since about November the 15th.
Yeah.
But one of the things that a lot of people do not appreciate in terms of how pollution affects the human body is that the inflammatory response that you alluded to at the beginning of your program just simply does not dissipate instantly. It takes quite a while. And so the clinical effects, the disease outcomes, also persist. And when you have one episode after another, as we have had, then you have a steady accumulation of the health consequences. You bring in a broader array of people who are having problems. You bring in more diseases. And if you want to think of the health consequences in three different ways, very simply, it's one, everybody's affected, even if they don't feel it. Their life expectancy is being shortened. Two, there's a subset of the population, the elderly and that have more chronic diseases, where we actually see increased rates of mortality from strokes and heart attacks, heart failure, sudden arrhythmias, and things like that. But what I think really ramps this up in terms of an emergency is in the last few years, it has become very clear from medical research that the most vulnerable subset of the population is the developing human embryo. And that critical window in the first 3 months after conception is an opportunity or is the critical window when organs are developed. And if the pregnant mother has to breathe air pollution during that time, just during that window, there can be lifelong and irreversible impacts to that person. They'll never have another chance to develop appropriately. So for certainly that part of the population, this window of pollution that we've had, it certainly is an emergency.
Yeah.
And that's a message that we're trying to actually get out there that even if you don't feel it, there's a certain subset of the population where it will have permanent, lifelong effects.
You've talked about the fact that you can get some of the big particles out of our lungs, but there's a lot that gets in there that will never get out again?
Yes, actually. If you look at autopsies of people who live in polluted areas, their lungs resemble the appearance grossly of smokers. And if you look at it under the microscope, you see the same thing. And one of the things that I like to try and help people understand what air pollution does to them by elaborating just a little bit on what it can do. These tiny particles can actually – they get into the bloodstream, and then they can actually penetrate the cell. They're so small they can penetrate the cellular membrane. They're even so small they can penetrate to the nucleus of the cell. And then they can start to have cause chemical reactions with even the chromosomes of the cell. So if you imagine a baby in the first 3 months of gestation and their chromosomes are developing and they're adding 250,000 brain cells per minute, but then that mother is breathing pollution and these little tiny particles are affecting that development, they can affect every single cell that is added to that baby's development. So every organ's affected. And that means the brain, the heart, the lungs. It means virtually everything that person will need to have a healthy life because those particles can penetrate into every single cell.
I want to play something that the governor was asked about this question about air quality. You have a petition that you've presented. You have a suggestion, a strategy, because this is a, as you say, it's an emergency you want them to deal with. The governor was asked about this last week at his news conference on January 24th. I wanted to get your reaction to this. Here's what he had to say.
I would hope that everybody understands that they have a role to play. When the doctors came to visit with me yesterday and bring their petition, I understand that they're concerned. I have the same kind of concern for dirty air. But I hope that they, in their journey to the Capitol, carpooled, rode tracks, came up on the front runner, took a bus, or if they're like too many of us, they just rode up in their automobiles and contributed to the problem as they're complaining about finding a solution.
How did you react to that?
I don't think that was the governor's finest moment. A lot of physicians in our group take this very seriously. In fact, most of the physicians in our community take our role as patient advocates very seriously. And we adopt that role even outside of our own offices or outside of our own operating rooms. We take the public health protection role very seriously.
But wait, but what was he saying? I mean, he's saying, I hope that because it seemed disdainful. So I'm trying to figure out why that is. Here's a group of physicians who are trying to – I know that some of the things that you're asking for, and we'll talk about some of these things, he thinks are not feasible for economic reasons and whatever kind of – I get that part. But I thought that was interesting that he put it that way.
We were disappointed that he put it that way. But I would like the governor to know, as well as a lot of the people out there listening – because the governor's sentiment is echoed by other people as well, that the people who are actually engaged in this kind of a project are people who have spent hours and hours, thousands of hours over the years. I have a colleague who's on our board who was riding his bicycle to work 2 days ago in the snowstorm. He believes in it that strongly. I ride my bicycle to the hospital about 75% of the time, and it would be more, but in a biking accident, I ruined my hip, and I have an artificial hip thanks to the commitment that I've had to trying to solve my own transportation contribution to the problem. So I'm disappointed that the governor might not really have an appreciation for the fact that there are people engaged in this particular cause who are actually living what they're asking people out there to do.
Judy Fays, I want to bring you into the conversation. To the question of what is being done by the government, in that same press conference, the governor presented this kind of litany of what he said the state is doing. He talked about the fact that they've spent billions on a track system and the front runner system, billions on road improvements. He talks about these idling programs, mentions $4 million for a watershed study in the Uinta Basin, this memorandum of understanding with other states, talks about trying to transition state vehicles to natural gas, the UCARE program. Are things being done?
Yes, absolutely. The state's in a kind of a tough position because they're responsible to put together a plan or a bunch of plans to send to the Environmental Protection Agency to show that we know what we can do to bring pollution levels down. And they've run into a couple of problems with that. And I don't know that it's really a matter of that they're not trying hard enough or they're not smart enough. It turns out that there's a real science problem here. You can't take the solution for PM 2.5 that worked in LA, and it won't work in Utah. And that's because of our unique geography and weather and the fact that we get snow on the ground. Those are such a big contributors to the problem that you can't just fix it by fixing the weather, because you can't fix the weather. Yeah. The only thing we do have control over is the pollution element of that. So the state is apparently doing some pretty cutting-edge work on understanding the chemistry, why this happens, and why it's so bad. And I am not on firm scientific footing on this, but my understanding is that that if Utah wasn't a basin that gets snow and gets these thermal inversions, that we wouldn't have a PM 2.5 problem. The geography is really such a controlling factor. But I don't think that that means that that we can back away from the responsibility we have. Regardless of why we have the pollution problem we do, it's a pollution problem that really affects people. And I know so many people with little children who didn't even want to take their kids to the grocery store. They were terrified of the long-term damage that they would cause to their children. And frankly, I'm not in a position where I can evaluate that. So I guess, as I said, I think that there really is a scientific problem here. And according to the data that I have, industry has done a lot. They have been forced by the federal government over the last decade at least to really spend a lot of money to clean up their operations. Frankly, again, I'm not an engineer, so I can't say exactly what they can do more. But the biggest proportions, more than half of the PM 2.5 in Salt Lake, it looks like 60% in Utah County and in Cache, and more than that in Cache County, yeah, is cars. So that's probably why the governor's saying it. But it sure sounds, I think, for most people, like the governor saying, it's your own damn fault. Fix it. But no one really knows what they can do. And so I think there's maybe a social science element of this that we haven't really conquered. And that is, how do you communicate to the public, well, this is something you can really do that will make a big difference, and we're going to help you do it,
yeah,
whether it's to provide better transit, more frequent transit, more convenient transit. What about maybe a tax credit for updating your car? Cars built prior to, I think it's 2004, can pollute 20 times more than the pollution of a car that was built in 2004 or after. So, I mean, maybe that's a cost-effective way to facilitate, and it's not a handout, but it's actually a pollution control tech strategy, maybe.
But it seems like you've got to find the thing where it hits home. That's why we had Tom on,
yeah,
is because he talks about, look, this is really personal. My granddaughter's being affected. I'm affected. Dr. Mensch, what do you think? I mean, what's the kind of trigger for people that if it's – is it an environment – sorry, an economic – sort of thing where it makes sense for them? Because one of the suggestions, one of the strategies you're hoping the government will adopt during this emergency, as you put it, is to make all means of mass transit for the rest of the winter free of charge.
We're not really going to have a substantial improvement in this situation until we really start to revolutionize the way we think of the problem. But let me back up a step. As bad as the current problem is, it is destined and on track to get even worse for several reasons. The state has permitted our largest industrial polluters to expand and pollute more. And in fact, the conventional wisdom has been passed around, and the governor's been one of the most prominent spokespersons for this idea that industry has done all they can. And so 3 or 4 years ago, we really dug into that to see. And we had engineers help us. We've had refinery engineers come to us and offer their help from out of state. We've had experts from all types of heavy industry help us evaluate whether or not our biggest polluters, Rio Tinto and the oil refineries, are really doing everything they can. And the answer is no, they're really not doing everything they can. But in addition to that, they have been given permits to expand and pollute even more. So if we don't put the brakes on that part of our pollution problem, that part of it's going to continue to get worse.
Do you concede that they are doing something?
Well, it depends on what you mean by something and what kind of time frame. They are trying to do something. There is a fair amount of public attention being paid to them, but they're not doing enough. And with the recent permitting process, we, like I said, have had it scrutinized by real experts and have identified many different ways that they could do more. They're resistant to that because it'll cost them some money. But let's take just one example, the oil refinery expansion proposals. There's a proposal, for instance, for Holly to virtually double their capacity. Now, they want to say they're going to pollute less, but what they mean is they'll pollute less per unit of product produced, not pollute less overall. They will be polluting more. Who benefits from that? Basically, Holly, because all the gas that they're going to produce by doubling capacity will go to Las Vegas and California. It will not affect local supplies. it will not decrease local gas prices. So that's an example where Holly will make a lot of money, in the neighborhood of a couple million, $200 million a year when the project's finished. The rest of us will pay the price for it.
Judy, is that why lawmakers and state leaders might be resistant to dealing with industry because of the economic implications like that? How is the government responding to that? I won't ask you to speak for the government, but what are you finding?
Again, I think that the folks who are trying to find a way to submit a PM 2.5 plan to the EPA are looking at everything. I think if they could figure out a way to justify a reasonable expenditure of money to get a reasonable reduction in pollution, that they would do it because they're under the gun. But I genuinely think that they're not really finding simple solutions. And they're still working on it. They have until the middle of the summer to do that. But I thought Brian's point was really quite good, and that is we're going to really need to think about it differently. It's a really different problem from anywhere else in the country, and we're going to have to figure out a way to make it work.
But what does that mean?
I don't think anyone knows.
Yeah. Do you know? Revolution. Yeah. I mean, you're saying
The point has been made. Judy made it just a minute ago that about 50 to 60% of our pollution comes from automobiles.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. Yeah. That's a no-brainer. Well, there are very simple things we can do to reduce that we're just not doing. Top of the list on the long list of things that we recommended to the governor last week with our letter. We can reduce freeway speed limits to 55 miles an hour. The Department of Energy put out advertisements about 2 or 3 years ago saying if you drop the vehicle speed on the average vehicle 75 to 55, the fuel efficiency improves about 22%. So you're going to pollute less. And in fact, dropping freeway speeds was one of the strategies that the EPA mandated for the state of Tennessee not too long ago. So the EPA thinks it works. And if those of us who are in our age group know that part of the oil embargo response in the 1970s was to have a national drop in freeway speed limits to conserve fuel.
Yeah.
We could do that, right? We could do it tomorrow. Everybody would save money. There'd be less highway deaths from accidents. But we're not doing it. We're not asking our citizens to participate in that.
So that's what you're saying is we're not asking for the shared sacrifice.
That's just one example
yeah.
of many where we're not even asking for a
okay.
sacrifice.
Let me get to a few more comments and questions. Here's an email from – I don't see a name here. Forgive me. I'm actually in the middle of packing all my things into a U-Haul and moving back to Oregon, primarily due to the air, this person writes. It's always been my goal to move back to my hometown in Oregon, but my health has forced me to go sooner than I had thought. I'm 25 years old, and over the last year – I've developed asthma, an inner ear issue, a rotating sinus infection that and he mentions some drugs that they're taking. All these things have also caused me to start grinding my teeth in my sleep. Let's go back to the phones. Greg is with us in Salt Lake. Greg, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No problem. Smog Lake City, I think, is what it should be called now. I am 45 years old. I'm the healthiest I've ever been in my whole life until this last winter. I've run a lot, and I don't even dare go out and run anymore. I feel like an elephant's on my chest, and it just has really, really kind of thrown me for a loop. One of the things I was thinking about, though, is maybe a part of the solution to the problem is on Red Air Days, the students of the University of Utah and Westminster, BYU, UVU, Salt Lake Community College, schools are closed and you have to telecommute. You have to get your classes, your coursework from online. I mean, I don't know how much of that would create part of the solution, but I don't hear anyone talking about that.
But this is what Brian mentioned. This is one of those elements of we've got to be creative. We've got to figure out certain things because we're at sort of that drastic stage.
For certain, we're at that stage. Now, in addition to some of these acute things we can do, like tomorrow morning, the governor can say, we're going to drop freeway speed limits to 55 for the rest of the winter. He could do that if he would. But then there are longer term issues. When the state legislature is perennially underfunding states' projects, the one agency that almost never suffers any funding shortage is UDOT. we continue to build highways in the same fashion and much the same blueprint as Los Angeles. And yet if you ask people, do you want to become the Los Angeles of the interior West in 10 years, nobody would say, yes, let's do that. But in fact, that's exactly what we're doing. Specific example, we're planning to build another freeway in Davis County, the West Davis Corridor, to make it more accessible for cars. If you build an infrastructure for cars, that's what you will get, pollution and vehicle emissions. And it certainly shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. But if you take that money and then invest in mass transit infrastructure, well, then you've got hope that we can solve the problem.
Can I just jump in here?
Please do.
I have a story that it's been posted about how in the legislature this year on environmental bills, there's nothing in air quality. If you go search the bill list, there was a task force, an economic development task force, which spent a couple of meetings on air quality and what can be done. It was actually promoted by the business community, this idea that we need to address it. But there really isn't anything on the table. So I think it's a good point that there really aren't steps being taken that could be. And while we have so many bills on so many other subjects, we don't have anything on that. And we also have a cut to DEQ that's in the budget this year.
So in an era or a year when we've had really terrible inversion, there's nothing at the legislature that deals with the air quality. And they're trying to cut the Department of Environmental Quality.
Right. And the DEQ, I think, is the only state agency that's been seeing cuts over the last decade, not only in personnel, but in funding as well.
Here's an email. Could a temporary state tax on gasoline be a feasible solution to lower the amount of drivers that are on the roads? What do you think?
Nobody likes the word tax.
Yeah.
Even liberals, what few Democrats there are in the state of Utah, they don't like the word tax either. But there are various ways you can manipulate the current tax structure, and you can call it something else, to disincentivize driving and to incentivize mass transit. We don't have the perfect solution on how to do that, but it doesn't seem like anybody's even attempting to do that.
Doctor, what's the biggest problem with mass transit, do you think? Why people aren't using it more? What's the biggest problem, would you say?
I'll give you my own personal experience. Several years ago, I tried to see what would be the most environmentally friendly way for me to get to the hospital. So I tried three different things. I tried bicycling, I tried running, and I tried the bus. The bus took longer than all the others. I could run to and from the hospital, and I lived 13 miles away. I could get to the hospital faster running than I could on the bus. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have enough buses. We don't have enough routes. And when the system isn't comprehensive enough, if it isn't broad-based enough, if it doesn't run often enough, it isn't realistic for people to use it. In order to get there, we've got to fund it. Our legislature has to be willing to say, we've reached the point where this has to have some priority. And as Judy just mentioned, even now, it still isn't on their radar. There is a real ongoing chronic antipathy towards environmental protection at the state capitol.
The question comes up as we were preparing for the show today. It kept coming up time and time and time again that it's expensive to take mass transit. It's come up already. Tom, you were mentioning it earlier. Would there be the political will, I don't know, this is just a guess, of course, Judy, but any sense at all that they want to deal with that question?
Another story we have in the paper today actually addresses that. Apparently, Governor Herbert met this week with UTA and UDOT to talk about ways that they can facilitate more use of mass transit. So I'm not really – we didn't get a lot of answers about what they discussed specifically.
Yeah, the question is what? Right.
Or when they might do it, but they apparently were talking about it.
Mary is with us in Sandy. Mary, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I always think when I hear about environmental problems, environmental issues, of the elephant in the room is there's just too many people, and especially in the states where children and having more and more children is so prevalent in the religious overtone of the state. But if we had less people, we would drive less big cars, and we would have less people in the valley.
Yeah.
And that's
so,
my only comment.
Well, it's a good comment, but what do you do about that? What's the piece of legislation that you impose upon people to keep them, get them to have fewer kids?
I think and drive smaller cars, or at least do hybrids or something.
Yeah.
I did like the comment before of trying to invest in buyback of old cars, things like that, to try to get people in smaller cars.
I guess what Mary's talking about is we need to be, again, going back to that question, we need to be creative. Judy, do you have anything
to say? Oh, I just wanted to jump in here. I just had a conversation recently with the Division of Air Quality, and they were saying that not only is our population growth rate, I think, 1.5 times the normal for the rest of the nation, but our vehicle miles traveled rate is double average. So we're driving more for the population that we do have. And the thing that's protected us was all those federal laws that required greater efficiency in automobiles and cleaner fuels. And now that's kind of catching up with us. So we were really fortunate to get those reductions in pollution because of those changes. But now, because we're driving so much more and we're growing so much faster, that's a big problem.
Ian writes this from Ogden. I think it's a waste of time to talk about having people voluntarily change their behavior. The people who are willing to do that are probably already doing it. We have to look, he writes, at different development patterns that don't just encourage endless driving to distant suburbs. We have to stop subsidizing the exact thing we don't want, which is more and more driving. Why have freeways that cost nothing to drive on and we charge money for public transit when it should be the other way around? A pollution carbon user fee based on our driving choices would be a capitalistic way to address the problem. Maybe registration fees based on miles driven and actual vehicle emissions. What do you think?
I think those are all very good ideas. I probably can share a little bit of conversations we've had with UDOT. When you have a discussion with the hierarchy of UDOT, they will always invoke the imperative of getting vehicles moving throughout the valley. And so that's how plans are made. And then ultimately, that's where money is committed. But what is not added into that equation is what will be the public health consequences if we do that? What will be the pollution consequences? What will be the economic development consequences of setting us up for more big box centers and so forth? So unfortunately, when we do things like urban planning, we still basically let the car dominate how we look at how this city is going to grow. Well, I would just like to mention that in addition to these bigger, broader problems, there are a lot of loose ends that aren't being tightened up. I'll just give you a couple examples that we mentioned in our letter to the governor. We have a handful of businesses that basically are in business to incinerate things, burn things from hazardous waste, and they create hazardous waste pollution. Not only do we not ask them to stop doing that during inversions, there's no reason why they should be doing it in the backyard of 1.5 million people at all. We have a hospital incinerator that has no business incinerating hospital waste right in everybody's backyard in South Davis County. We have ATK that has permits to do open burning of hazardous waste at 3 different sites along the Wasatch Front. And I don't think hardly anybody realizes that. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever during inversion or even when the air is clear. So there are a lot of loose ends like that that we're not tying up at all.
Here's Sandy. She writes, there's a bus I catch 2 blocks from my house that drops me off in front of my office building about 4 miles away. The $4.70 fare to and from work is more than gas for my truck. It's definitely about cost for me. I rode it only a couple of times this month. When I do ride the bus, it has about 5 people on it. We need to get public transportation rebranded, Sandy writes. I've heard the kids call it the shame train. Just seems like it's an attitude, right? A cultural sort of thing that you need to get at. Here's something from Ellie who writes, I'm a 30-year-old pregnant woman. This is my first child, and it took me a while for my husband and I to conceive. I am now 5 months along. I've done everything I possibly could to give this child a healthy start, except I can't control a major factor, the air. It makes my heart heavy to think that living here could greatly affect the health of my unborn child. Well, let me shift gears here as we're headed towards the end. Tom Wharton, we started with you. Let me come back to you and the rest of you on this question. Do you feel optimistic that we're at a sort of a tipping point, that people are going to start thinking more seriously about all of this? Or once the air is clear, as it is today, we're just going to sort of settle back into the way we've always been?
I wish I could say I was optimistic, but I think I'm pessimistic. I don't think people still are ready to face the music in terms of some of the regulations, some of the things that need to be done, some of the speed limits. We're used to having it the way we want to have it, and I guess I would say that I'm pessimistic. I think things may even have to get worse before people really get serious.
Dr. Mitch, not a lot of time, but what do you think?
I'm optimistic, actually, and I'll tell you why. In the last 2 weeks, business leaders have contacted me volunteering their help. And we have meetings now set up between our group, physicians, public health advocates, and business leaders who are now aligned in trying to actually address the problem. And that may be the missing element that we haven't had to this point. And if we can actually add the business community behind this effort, I think things have a chance to really change.
Judy, from your perspective as a journalist, what do you sense? Do you think the ground is shifting a bit?
I do think there's a lot more attention. I think the legislative hearings last fall on air pollution tied to the economy were the first ever really devoted exclusively to air pollution, and I think that's wonderful. I think the pressure that the public is putting on government is also a big help.
It's Judy Fays, reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, where she covers pollution, climate change, and nuclear waste. Judy, thanks very much for being with us. Tom Wharton, a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. Tom, thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it. And Dr. Brian Mensch, president of the group Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Thank you very much,
Doug,
as well. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Michael Havey and from Simone Seikley. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Thanks to our producers, Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.